Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners all around the world? Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. This week, we sit down with Vaik, a longtime Bitcoiner. Many of you will know him from Bitcoin Twitter, and it was a fantastic conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Before we dive into it, let's talk about Swan. You already know Swan is the best place to auto-stack Bitcoin in the United States. With low fees and easy setup, just connect your bank account, set the amount and frequency of your buys, and rest easy as Swan automatically buys your Bitcoin for you. You can just average out that cost basis over time. Don't worry about the market volatility, just Swan and chill. You can get started using my ref link, swanbitcoin.com/Brady. Get $10 of Bitcoin dropped into your account, and you'll also support the work on this podcast, my work on this podcast. Really appreciate it. Swan is also making a splash on the Bitcoin content scene with Swan Signal, the other podcast that I host. We broadcast live every Wednesday on Twitter and YouTube, and then we make the audio available on an audio podcast feed at swansignalpodcast.com. We just had a show that was amazing with Samson Mao and Parker Lewis. We've got next week Lynn Alden and Jeff Booth, an incredible combination. You're not going to want to miss that one. And then Robert Breedlove pairs up with Swan founder Corey Clipston. That is sure to be a firecracker. They both love Taleb. They both love macro and big time thinking. That episode is going to get cosmic as fuck. You're going to want to catch that one. So go to swansignalpodcast.com, subscribe right now, add it to your Bitcoin rotation. You will not regret it. Go to youtube.com/swansignal, hit that subscribe button. It's great stuff. Please, please check it out. There's 20 great shows in the archive already. Okay, here we go. Today, we sit down with Vaik at Vaikraj on Twitter. That's at V-A-K-E-R-A-J. Vaik has been around for a long time, and in this one, we go back in history and talk about Bitcoin in like the 2013 to 2016 era. There's a lot of fun stuff to cover there, a lot of fun diving back into history. There'll be some new stuff and stories for a lot of you who, like me, came in 2017 or later. We talk about Bitcoin in the here and now as well, and we move on to some fun speculation about the coming decade, get a little cosmic. This is good stuff. It'll pump you up. It's really fun to dive into Bitcoin's history and hear all of those war stories. All right, I know you're all going to love this one. Enjoy.
About it, or he asked me about Bitcoin. I was like, oh, listen to this guy's podcast.
That's fucking amazing. You have a Citizen Bitcoin shirt.
I gotta say, the logo design is really nice.
Yeah, it's on point, right? It's the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance.
Oh, I hadn't thought of it in that terms. I just thought it's symmetrical.
Yeah.
It's very visually appealing.
It's got the sun rising.
Exactly.
That's all Nick Ward, man. Ward,
really?
Is the designer, nice. Yeah.
And the shirt's good quality too. I like it.
So I gotta shout him out for that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Awesome. Okay. Man. Well, you're putting out so much content these days.
It's a machine. I'm trying to, make the machine more efficient as much as possible. And I keep getting asked to make more content. And so I'm trying to figure out where to draw the line, because some point you gotta say no to new ideas. But
well, I do love the live streams. Like, if I'm like scrolling through Twitter, or I have to be on YouTube at the time.
Yeah.
Like, it's something about live, the nature of live things.
Yeah.
It like draws you in.
Yeah,
like,
I like
always,
it too.
Always tune in.
I feel like we're really developing like a pretty proper Bitcoin media system. You know, like outside of the traditional mainstream, there's great stuff that's available. Live stuff that's available every day.
Yeah. I can't keep up.
No, it's just a lot of choice, you know, and you can just kind of pick and choose based on guests and topics that you're interested in. And, you know, like your Bitcoin media consumption definitely changes over time. You know, I was at the point for about 18 months after I fell in the rabbit hole where I was voraciously consuming everything that fell.
You know, it was such a drought back in the day. I guess we can talk about it more, but man, like before 2017, there was like one podcast I liked.
Yeah. No, I mean, most of the podcasts like that we love today came out around that time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like late 2017, yeah. Tales from the Crypt, Stefan Levera, What Bitcoin Did was like late. Mine was like really early 2018. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was just hanging out with my friend Tommy. I hadn't started interviewing anybody else yet, and it was just sort of a drop in the bucket Bitcoin podcast. Although there's still a few hardcore Citizen Bitcoin listeners out there that'll be like, yeah, man, I've listened to every... I started listening when you were just like chilling with your friend Tommy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've listened to most of yours. If I don't listen to it, I definitely click the download button automatically when I see it come up in the feed.
Yeah, as a support.
I do want to make content myself going forward, but I don't want to do just another podcast because I think that ground is already saturated. Yeah, I know. I want to do something different, but I have to think about like, what kind of media we're lacking in.
Yeah.
YouTube is definitely a space where, unfortunately, most of the eyeballs are still on like trading, you know, platforms. If you Google Bitcoin or if you YouTube search Bitcoin, it's like it's garbage.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we got Swan Signal going. We're trying to establish an actual Bitcoin channel. We've got a couple shows going there. We've got a Bitcoin FAQ with Jan Pritzker, who's answering basic questions. So we're hoping those.
Okay. Like,
trying to get those into the algorithm so that when people start asking basic questions, like 85 different questions, noob questions about Bitcoin, we want those to start ranking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hand his book out like candy. I mean, like, if there's something, because it's short, it's not too expensive. It's like $7 on Amazon.
Yeah.
I've given multiple people copies of his book. It's real simple.
Yeah.
No prior knowledge necessary. It's a good one.
It's a 2.5-hour read. Guy Swan reads it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah, I should do that.
Yeah, an Audible. Yeah, it's great. It's a great starter. Great.
Awesome. All right. I'll probably stop the video just because to make sure, you know, probably helps with the bandwidth a little bit.
Okay. Sounds good, man.
Great.
All right. So let's get into your story, dude. I mean, you've been around for a while. Like, when did you get in?
I first heard of Bitcoin in April of 2013, and I was shilling it almost immediately, which probably isn't such a great thing in retrospect. I think it's good to have a little bit of skepticism because there's a lot of scams out there. But yeah, April 2013 was really my introduction to Bitcoin, and that kind of what we say, you know, how a number goes up draws people in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was April. There were two separate bull runs in 2013. There was like March, April, May, when I think the price started somewhere around like 15 or 25 bucks and then it shot to like 250 or something. That's when I first heard about it. It was in the news a little bit. And then there's a separate bull run, I think in November, December, leading to January of 2014, where it shot up to $1,200, right? In a span of like 2 months. But yeah, when it broke $100 when I first heard about it. Prior to then, I was already, you know, basically a libertarian, not super familiar with Austrian economics, but I was aware of it. I was a fan of Ron Paul in 2008, 2012, totally on his end the Fed bandwagon, and I was a supporter of the gold standard. So it made intuitive sense to me. And I think the thing, the actual specific thing that I heard about Bitcoin from was I was on YouTube and I saw a video of Jeffrey Tucker. Do you know who he is?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So he had a video, I think some interview with him, and it said how Bitcoin will end the nation state, which is,
Woo,
yeah, plan, exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah. If you go into YouTube and you search for that, you'll probably see that video. And I mean, I just read that. I was fascinated from the get go and I just kept searching on YouTube. I think I saw some interview with Amir Taki on Russia RT. Is that Russia Today?
Yeah, Russian right? Today, yeah.
Yeah, he was arguing with some other people.
That's Max Kaiser's platform.
Yep, yeah. It wasn't Max Kaiser's show, but it was another show, and he was arguing with somebody else about it. I think he was wearing, like, a Mozilla shirt in that interview. So, I mean, I just was fascinated from the get-go. And I guess, you know, the rest is history. It took me about – I didn't buy Bitcoin right away because it – I was a believer, I guess you could say, but figure out the technical part was took a little bit of time. There weren't as many resources then. I was trying to buy on, like, BitInstant. That's Charlie Shrem's company, if anybody recalls it. But, like, that was – it was so awful. Like, you had to, like, go to, like, CVS or Walgreens and – because I was trying to buy anonymously. And you had to, like, give them cash, and then you had to, like, send some I don't know, account somewhere, and then they'd credit you, and it never worked for me. So eventually I just, like, gave in and used Coinbase, like, 6 months later.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, going the privacy route, especially back then, is difficult. It's still difficult trying to use BISC or, like, paying a massive premium at a Bitcoin ATM, which also actually has its own privacy problems too. So
all the Bitcoin ATMs I've had to use generally require you to scan your driver's license.
Yep, exactly.
And I mean, local Bitcoins was good for quite a while there, but I mean, it would just basically be like a directory of, like, dealers in your area, and you could just, like, text them or something and meet up. But I think they've added KYC lately, right?
Yeah, yeah, and local Bitcoins. Yeah. So now it's just I mean, you can still do it, but you have to, you know, put in all the manual work. And if you're in a place where or a city where it's a little bit more concentrated, you can find Bitcoiners to trade with. But it's, you know, if you're elsewhere, if you're not in a city, then it's going to be hard to find someone to physically meet up with and trade Bitcoin.
Yep. So back then, I guess the first things I read was the Nakamoto Institute. I think Nakamoto Institute's been up their website since, like, late 2012, maybe, or very early 2013.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's only, you know, I read through all the stuff there probably two or three times over, but there's only so many times you can read the same Pierre's articles, Bitstein's, Krawitz's stuff.
Yep.
Search for new content. It was honestly like a drought back then.
Yeah, there wasn't much. Little. It's like Andreas Nakamoto Institute and then like Nick Szabo's blog.
Oh, I used to thirst over new Andreas videos. Every time he drops something, I'd watch it three times.
Yeah.
I can't really watch his content anymore, but
this is that devotion, this just utter devotion that Bitcoin inspires. And it's like, you literally cannot get enough. Like I was saying at the top, like, you know, for 18 months, I was voraciously consuming every single Bitcoin podcast that came out, no matter what. It was 1.8 or 2Xing through these things, like, just, you know, couldn't miss one, couldn't get enough. And like,
yeah.
My listening habits have changed, you know. Now, once you come up to a certain speed, then you just kind of start, you know, cherry picking certain episodes that you want to, like, kind of, you know, level up on, but you don't need to listen to it all anymore.
Yeah. I will say that I did believe in the fast, cheap narrative. So I wasn't necessarily that, like, perfectly knowledgeable on Bitcoin. I didn't really get a lot of the trade-offs involved in scaling on chain.
Right.
But when the block size war started to heat up, and then you start thinking about a little more and you hear the contrary perspectives, then you start to think a little more. Also, you know, Gavin was a lot back then. Gavin Andreessen was the guy you'd hear on a lot of podcasts and stuff. Like, he was on, you know what Twit is, This Week in Tech. It's a pretty popular tech podcast, you know.
Yep,
you'd see him there. You'd see him on other podcasts. He was kind of the public face of Bitcoin, and he was obviously, as we know, in favor of bigger blocks. So,
and he was still
kind of my default position.
He was still in control of the repo at the time. I mean, he had a, you know, as far as I understand, because I wasn't around then, but he had a pretty stellar reputation among Bitcoiners. Like, he was well respected.
Yeah, he comes off as a very soft-spoken, humble guy.
Yeah.
And probably to some extent he is. I mean, he's not, you know, as nearly loud and aggressive as, say, Craig Wright or Roger Ver.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think he's been proven to be wrong about, you know, the block size issue. And I think, yeah, the repo, he had control of the repo until, what, like, shortly after the Craig Wright incident. That's when they basically, I don't know if he surrendered his key or they took it from him.
Yeah, basically it was taken from him, as far as I understand. And, like,
yeah,
it was sort of the up-and-coming new guard of Bitcoin Core, because, you know, Gavin and Mike Hearn sort of represented this, you know, kind of directly... handed, you know, power handed directly down from Satoshi, and so had that sort of swag. And there was a new crop of Bitcoiners who didn't necessarily have the kind of direct contact with Satoshi, but they, they were very convicted about not increasing the block size and scaling through layers. But that was just, hard to see. And this was block size was the easy way out. Mm-hmm. And even Matt Odell in a recent episode, I think it was, a Rabbit Hole Recap episode, was talking about how, he was a big blocker at first too. Like, it just seemed easy and the way out. Let's just get this done,
Yeah. I mean, I remember I look back at some of the texts and emails and other chats that I had with friends back in 2013 when I was trying to shill Bitcoin to them. And one of the things I incorrectly told them was that it was cheaper than, say, credit cards, and that was another argument in favor of it, which obviously now I realize is wrong. But actually, what you were saying about Hearn and Gavin being the old guard,
yeah.
Just to push back on that a little bit, if you look at, I don't know exactly where, but Greg Maxwell has actually kind of debunked that idea a little bit, and that Hearn and Gavin were the public faces of Bitcoin. Really, since 2010-11, it was other people doing the hard work on the code base, on the Bitcoin Core code base. So Peter Woola, Maxwell, Luke Dash Jr., the usual names. And that they were actually the ones writing the code. And then, I don't know, Gavin was just out there taking the credit for it.
Yeah.
Because he was the one showing up on podcasts.
Right.
But that really, the technical community was always against larger block sizes. It's just that there was this guy out appearing out on the media saying otherwise.
Right.
Yep.
And then there were those guys started attacking the kind of the technical crew by, kind of saying there was this consolidation of Bitcoin Core maintainers, top Bitcoin Core contributors. At certain companies, namely Blockstream. And then there was this, plan to create the sidechain and sell access to the sidechain. And so the small blocks narrative was really just a marketing ploy to solidify the business model of Blockstream. So do you remember that sort of narrative emerging, and what did you think?
I don't
of
recall
it
exactly when Blockstream was founded, but this debate predates Blockstream, without a doubt.
Sure.
I mean, it's the first indication. So my first year to 2 years of Bitcoin, I was not even aware of the block size debate. I didn't even know it was a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew that there was a block size limit, but I knew there was actually contention about it. I don't think I became aware of it until maybe 2015,
right?
When the XT debate started heating up. And what year was Mike Hearn's rage quit? That might have been 2016, I think.
Let's look it up real quick.
So if I recall correctly, the way it went was, first was Bitcoin XT, where they were going to do 20 megabyte block sizes. And then they said, okay, we'll compromise. And they cut down to 2 megabytes. And somewhere in this time was the Hong Kong meeting, where there was, I think, the Scaling Bitcoin conference, right? It was in Hong Kong. And Adam Back, as a compromise, proposed a 2-4-8 plan. And ever since then, that's been thrown in our faces, Adam Back promised 2 megabytes, then 4 megabytes, and 8 megabytes. And then, you reneged on that promise, which I would say Adam Back doesn't get to negotiate on behalf of all of us.
Right.
Exactly. Right. The people have to adopt it. And so, he didn't even.
Mike Hearn was January 14th, 2016, is when he published the end of the Bitcoin experiment.
So by that point, XT had failed, and then Bitcoin Classic, which was the follow-up compromise where they said, okay, we'll do a 2 megabyte block size. That failed too, and then they said, okay, we'll just go balls to the wall, and we'll just Bitcoin Unlimited was the next one they proposed, which was obviously, as the name implies, no block size limit. And then I think all this was this was from 2015 to 2017. And then obviously the hard fork was August 1st, 2017. Right. When they finally said, screw it, we'll fork off.
Right. The S2X fork that had a coding error and just completely died on the attempted fork.
Yeah, block. So I think the S2X was SegWit 2X, for everyone out there, was proposed in April or May of 2017. I still remember waking up from work one day, and it was during Consensus, right? The Consensus conference in New York, right?
The New York Agreement, as it was called.
Barry Silbert, right, got everybody in a room, and he's like, "Okay, we're all going to do this hard fork. We're going to implement SegWit, and then we're going to do the hard fork like 3-4 months later."
Right.
And I remember it being announced, and I bet if I look back at my Twitter back then, I launched into a screen. I'm like, "Who the fuck is this guy to just announce this? To just collect people in a room and announce it?"
Yeah.
Like, if they could do that, just thinking conceptually, if they could do that, where they could gather a bunch of business leaders in a room, a bunch of CEOs, and hard fork Bitcoin, what does that imply about its censorship, or that it's immutability, it's decentralization? Right. They could just always do it again, except they could implement blacklists or something else.
Yep. So it really didn't matter what the New York Agreement was, the particulars that came out of it. It was just the idea that this group of people could get together in a room in New York and then come out and announce, this is what will happen with Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it was everybody.
Yeah.
DCG, right, which is Barry Silbert's company,
yeah,
Digital Currency Group, Coinbase, Zappo, BitPay. It was every major company outside of, except for Blockstream, I think at that time was the only company that did not agree to it, which actually is kind of ironic because I think DCG is one of their investors, so they kind of went against one of their investors to oppose that agreement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then weren't So obviously, that was in April and May of 2017. SegWit was integrated on August 1st, and that's the same day that Bitcoin Cash worked off.
Right.
And then there was that little interim period between August 1st and I think November 15th of 2017 when the 2X hard fork was going to happen, and that's when... So I think from April, that summer of 2017 was the SegWit, UASF, right? UASF. Right.
UASF, yep. The user activated soft fork.
Everybody put it in their profile.
Myself
included for a little bit. I tried to, as a joke, I was at a baseball game that summer and I tried to start a UASF chant. Everybody stared at me.
What the heck does that mean? They're like, everyone, you know, besides Bitcoin is just like United States Air Force.
And then No2X was from like August to November, right? And we had Samson Mao was putting out his hats.
Yeah.
I wish I bought one of them. I never did.
You can still buy one.
Oh, really?
They're on his hat store. I think it's Exilion.com, which by the way, I was on there yesterday and it's freaking hilarious because it's like tongue in cheek, taking itself super seriously as like this global fashion brand. it's pretty funny. You should check it out at Exilion.com.
Okay. Yeah, I'll do that. And then so there was the futures for the SegWit 2X fork trading on Bitfinex. And I think it was trading at like generally around 0.15 of BTC.
Yeah.
Which so a lot of people were like eager for it to happen.
Yeah.
Right? Like I remember I think Mr. Hoddle and like Shinobi were like, yeah, we'll just dump it and increase our stack by like 15%.
Yeah, exactly.
But it just never went through. I think like 3 days before they canceled it.
Yeah,
that was the battle of 2017. But it's a culmination of like 4 or 5 years of arguments, maybe even longer. I mean, if you go back to, they say that all these debates that we have today are literally just rehashes of stuff that was debated on Bitcoin Talk in 2009, 10, 11.
Yeah, I think there was even a, if I remember correctly, there was even a post about it in a thread like in 2009, like, you know, just a couple of months after the code was released. I think if I have read this post before, it took me a moment to go back and find it, but somebody brought up, hey, you know, what happens when it was pretty soon. Cause I guess a few months block size limit hadn't even existed yet. Satoshi sort of tossed it in there, you know, late 2009, I think, or maybe early 2010. And I do remember within a couple of months, like, hey, this block size limit could be a problem.
Yep.
In the future. And Satoshi was just like, oh yeah, that's okay. We'll just increase it when we need to, you know, it's just a spam cap for now.
Yeah. I mean, Satoshi is should be respected, but not worshipped.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I think
we don't have heroes.
I think he was human, liable to mistakes just like anyone else. He was, I mean, this is super early, 2009-10. I don't think that the first mining pool, right, was Slush Pool, right?
Yes.
Ever, yeah. And that had not emerged until maybe late 2010, 2011. So he didn't have the opportunity to see the emergence of mining pools and some of the centralization risks there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, Satoshi, he can make mistakes. We all saw. Everyone knows about Hal's post about how he doesn't think it'll scale on chain, and that ultimately there will be banks, and that'll right. be one of the scaling methods. So I mean, I agree with a lot of that. But really, BitcoinTalk.org, if you think about it, that site is a treasure trove. I think I came personally a little too late for it, in the sense that when I got in 2013, our Bitcoin Reddit was the dominant platform. And then I think Bitcoin Twitter, I don't know a specific date, but it's really emerged more since like 2016, right?
Yeah.
But BitcoinTalk.org was the place, and it's, you know, it's a treasure trove because if you think of Bitcoin or Satoshi as Jesus, let's say, a Jesus yeah. type figure, that's where he did a lot of his writing, and that's where his early disciples all posted.
Right.
Yep. I mean, I hope that somebody is archiving it, because there's a lot yes. of valuable threads on there about the early days and what people thought.
I believe Nakamoto Institute is mirroring it and has a copy.
Mm-hmm.
So at nakamotoinstitute.org. And there's a book called The Book of Satoshi,
yeah.
which is literally just all of the writings available from Satoshi, including some private emails that had been made public mm-hmm. until the publication of the book, which is like 18 months ago, I think. That book is fascinating.
Oh, the Book of Satoshi, right, by yeah. Phil Champagne?
Yes, I think that's yeah. correct.
Yeah, I bought a copy of that book. I went to, I've only ever been to two Bitcoin conferences, although I will be at BitBlock Boom next month.
Nice.
And in 2015, January 2015, I went to TNABC Miami, the North American Bitcoin Conference in Miami, and he was there. He was selling a copy of it. So yeah, I got a signed copy of that from him.
Yeah, I love it.
It's a great book.
It's a great book. It's almost like the New Testament of Bitcoin, or maybe the Old Testament of Bitcoin.
Yeah, he just goes through all Satoshi's writings and kind of gives a little bit of context.
Yes, fantastic. I have it on Audible, and it's something I'll throw it on every once in a while. Like mm-hmm. I'm working out in the yard or something, and just like listen to some the you know the original writings. And there's you know like you mentioned earlier, there's very prescient. You know, ideas expressed in these books, but there's also, you know, the limitation, like you couldn't see the future that has unfolded. And I would, you know, I think the idea that Bitcoin will scale in layers mm-hmm. makes sense. I'm not sure that Satoshi was, you know, well-versed in, you know, layered protocol development necessarily. And
yeah,
you know, and those kinds of things, which is why, you know, it's has attracted the people that we need to sort of take it to the next level.
Yeah. I mean, he was only around for 2 years, right? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, if we talk about the debut of the network on January 3rd, 2009, and then he was gone by, was it December 2010 or January 2011? That his last post was, I could, yeah, look it up on.
It was right after Gavin Andreessen went to the CIA.
Yep, December 13th, 2010 was his last post.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gavin will visit the CIA post on mm-hmm. April 27th, 2011. And
oh, I don't see that one. I see the last one, December 12th, 2010.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's when Gavin posted that he was going to visit the CIA, and I think that was mm-hmm. the end of it.
Yeah. I don't know if that's necessarily the impetus, and I don't want to blame Gavin for doing that because let's be frank, the CIA was going to find out about it one way or another.
Of course. So, yeah. A way to try to present it in a, you know, in a good light, that this is something that is not a threat mm-hmm. to, it's not a threat to like, you know, CIA investigations, et cetera.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, and if the CIA could shut it down, then what's the point, right? It was all for naught, but luckily he built a robust system. And then, so yeah, one of his last posts, right, was the December 11th, 2010, Satoshi wrote, "It would have been nice to get this attention in any other context. WikiLeaks mm-hmm. has kicked the hornet's nest and the swarm is headed towards us." So it's very clear that he was maybe getting a little panicky.
And bounced.
Yep. Another post on BitcoinTalk.org, I'll tell you what, I read this. This is from November 24th, 2013. This is by a guy under the pseudonym Rpietila, R-P-I-E-T-I-L-A. I don't know if he's still active, but I remember reading this in November 2013, and he basically just laid out that he thought the price of Bitcoin would be in the millions within 4 years from then, which has proven me wrong. But I mean, I swear to God, I read that and I was like, I just turned super bullish immediately. Basically, he took the price increases from prior to then, so 2009 to 13, and he just extrapolated it out. Which, to be fair, there, I mean, even though the price since then through today has still been tremendous, it hasn't been quite at that speed on a percentage basis.
Right.
But I mean, just reading that, I was like, holy shit, I gotta get into this.
Yeah, and so did you try any mining back then? It was still possible.
2013? I feel like maybe, I mean, I don't have an ASIC or anything.
Yeah.
I don't know if mining on my laptop would have been feasible. I feel like maybe 2011 or 12 would have been the very last year we could have done that. But no, I never mined. Always bought, just bought and stored. I mean, my method of cold storage has changed over the years. I mean, back then, there was no hardware wallets, right? The Trezor was the first hardware wallet, if I recall correctly. I don't know exactly. I think that debuted in maybe 2014, 2015. So back then, I was using paper wallets, which is something I don't really recommend people do now. There was bitaddress.org, which was, right, you go to the site and you would move your mouse around or you type in some mumbo jumbo numbers on your keyboard, which would add entropy, and then it would generate a paper wallet and you could print it. And I put a lot of money on that. And in retrospect, I realized, man, that was really stupid.
Yeah.
if there was malicious code on there, all my money would be gone.
Right. Right. Yeah. What about Bitcoin Core? Were you using the Bitcoin Core wallet?
It took me a couple years to learn to run a node, dude. It actually was the block size debate that taught me about the importance of running a node. Because actually before that, I wasn't really, for the first couple of years, I wasn't really knowledgeable what a node was.
Right.
It was the debate, the block size debate. So in some sense, the block size debate taught people about the things that, you know, running a node, decentralization, trade-off risks, the risks of centralization creeping into the system.
Yeah.
So it was very beneficial in some sense. Even worse, not only did I use paper wallets to store everything, I was in school at the time, and I was printing them off on the school printer.
Yeah.
In my own. That was, luckily I moved all the money from there, but there's a lot of mistakes I made in the early days. I guess it's part of learning.
Were you fortunate enough to not lose any or much Bitcoin?
I'm very fortunate. I've lost. I have never been hacked to this date. I have lost a couple. I was trying to dump some BCH for BTC a couple years ago, and I sent it to like a bad address or something, trying to shapeshift, and so I screwed that up. Lost a few thousand bucks that way. And actually, I got fished a little bit just like a few months ago. I had a friend who I know from the old, I used to attend the Miami Bitcoin meetups back in the day. And I had a friend from there who messaged me on Telegram asking, like, he does some OTC trading. So he asked me if I could front him some BTC. And I sent it to him. And then later it turned out that it was not him. That was just a few $100. So I've lost a little bit here and there, but by and large, I've missed the big mistakes. I never had money on Gox. I mean, frankly, Gox collapsed in I think it was
March 2014, something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, around then. But if you were on our Bitcoin regularly, you were people hearing people complain about it going back to at least like 8-9 months beforehand. So the signs were there. So I never had my money on Gox. Never put money on Quadriga or even Bitfinex or any of the other ones that got hacked. So, yeah, I dodged all the major bullets. I mean, really, cold storage is beautiful.
See, I mean, you weren't interested in trying to trade for these emerging shit coins like Litecoin and Filecoin.
I've never understood the day trading mentality.
Yeah.
It's maybe I just didn't have enough time on my hands.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it does take an insane amount of time. It's 24/7 global market. Like, you just can't stay on top of it. And totally illiquid markets too, you know?
Yeah. I never got why people trade, but there's people out there that are compulsive gambling addicts. So it's the same thing.
It is hard, you know, to look at, I remember, you know, I came in early 2017. So I was watching the Absolute Mania, you know, and people like all the Ethereum heads, like, you know, bragging about their like, you know, gajillion X gains, from buying into, the pre-sale, Ethereum pre-sale and everything. And
yeah, that pre-sale started in 2015, I think.
Yeah. Right. So that was kind of the first big, you know, Bitcoin gain, if you're, you know, using BTC as your unit of account when you're trading this stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, I bought in to, you know, the next Ethereums like Cardano, which I swear is like just an insane marketing machine, like Cardano and EOS and those and the like, you know, they're beautiful websites, you know, like credentialed, you know, advisors and people working on the projects. And they just raise so much money, and all they do now is travel the world and release, you know, announcements and roadmaps, and hardly anything ever gets done of any consequence.
Yeah,
and people are still just waiting. Like, now you see them on crypto Twitter. Some of these things are up 300% against Bitcoin this year, which if you look at the, you know, you zoom out and you look, that's, they're still 90%+ down against Bitcoin.
You know, I mean, look at Ripple, dude. Right. Ripple was founded, I think, in 2013.
Yeah.
Literally, it's just been a series of them announcing banking partnership after banking partnership after banking partnership, you know, yada yada. Bank of Malaysia is signing. Well, what they do is they do this real clever trick where this company is signing a contract with Ripple Labs. And so they publicly announce it. The price of XRP pumps, which they're not adopting XRP. They're just doing some arrangement with Ripple Labs. And then obviously Ripple Labs is continually selling XRP from their stash. I mean, it's such an obvious marketing ploy.
Yeah.
And so every year, every month or so, you'll hear about a new partnership. And there's a guy who's, I don't necessarily recommend his reading, so he's anti-BTC also. There's someone on Twitter called Trolley McTrollface. He has a website where he's gone into Ripple's marketing and he's like, he's gone through all their old partnerships, and then like if you go and call or you follow up these partnerships that were signed, you know, several months or years ago, almost all of them have fizzled out.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of these partnerships are just like an agreement to a very small agreement to like test using Ripple as an international payment rail with like $1 million or some tiny drop in the bucket, right?
Yeah.
And so they're performing like a month-long test where they're going to send some money back and forth over Ripple, and then it's just like, oh, okay, this is not that great. Okay, bye-bye. You know.
So even though he hates Bitcoin too, I do think his blog's worth reading. It's trzerolly.com. Trolley McTrollface blog, and he's got post after post just dissecting Ripple. And here's one: Ripple only had one real client in 2017. Ripple's little secret, XRapid, which is one of their products, uses Swift.
Yeah.
Ripple Net isn't a network and never will be. Building a fraud case, Ripple's public relations tricks, Ripple's circular business model. So it's like Ripple sells XRP. Ripple pays another company to become a partner. Ripple pays new partner to tell everyone it's using Ripple, right? So that's why you see all the Twitter posts and the blog posting. Such and such bank. It's always some bank. It's never like Bank of America. It's always like some bank you never heard of in like a foreign country.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, yada yada bank in Indonesia.
Right.
And then the XRP goes up on the news as investors pile onto the coin, and then they dump it. And that's very similar to, I mean, EOS. EOS, I guess, kind of copied the Ethereum model.
You know, and now it's happening on DeFi. You know, just these things.
Well, like DeFi is an attempt to repump Ethereum.
Yeah, it is. It's just the next iteration of you know, Ethereum's purpose in the world. And
then of course EOS's creator was what's his name?
Was it Jed McCaleb?
So Jed McCaleb has his own history. EOS was Daniel Larimer, who first did BitShares, and then he left BitShares, and that's obviously like trended to zero, to start Steemit, which was the social media blockchain company. And then he left that to do EOS. And I guess EOS is the most successful one right now because it's still multi-billion dollars and market capitalization.
Yep.
Maybe it's the final stop. I mean,
just ride that for so many years, decades, if you wanted to.
Yeah, no, he's made out like a bandit. He's probably, in my sense, him and Jed McCaleb are the two most successful scammers. McCaleb started Mt. Gox, right? And there's basically, I don't want to say evidence, but evidence. There's evidence that he handed over to Mark Karpeles already in the red. He gave it to Mark Karpeles for free.
Yeah, but it was already
Who hands a company off for free if it's worth something? He was trying to get out before the thing blew up.
The Ponzi scheme was up.
Yeah, so Mark Karpeles is, you know, he's not exactly the brightest guy, but I don't think his heart was in the wrong place. And he came in and realized pretty soon that there was a lot of money missing. And then things just slowly got worse until it blew up.
Yep.
So then Jay McCaleb went and started Ripple.
Yep.
Which he
$20 billion worth of tokens, Ripple tokens,
and then he got out of that, and now he's on Stellar. So both these guys have shown an amazing ability to just pivot from one project to the next, and they'll always get out of the last one before the last one blows up.
Yeah,
because they see the warning signs.
Right.
Yep.
So and then they start something new.
So those guys are two very experienced scammers. Was another one. Yeah. So Charles Hoskinson, the Cardano guy, was part of the Ethereum founding team. And apparently now he's mad that when they book him for interviews, they refer to him as Ethereum co-founder and not Cardano co-founder, because they're, you know, the journalist is pumping his old scam, not his new scam.
He's like, yeah, please mention Cardano.
He had a little rant on Twitter the other day.
He just portrays, you know, this jet setting lifestyle, styles himself as this sort of Renaissance man who is on par with the greatest minds of the Renaissance era. He names his projects after these people. And ADA itself is named after Ada Lovelace, you know, like one of the greatest, you know, original programmers.
Okay.
Back in the days, she worked with Charles Babbage in England, and you know, as a woman, didn't get the recognition she deserved until, you know, quite recently. But she was writing code for an imaginary machine that Charles Babbage had written out on paper. And was you know, using logic to write if-then statements and loops, etc. That would accomplish, you know, actual code without having the benefit of executing it and seeing errors, etc. Mm-hmm. And so absolutely.
When was this?
Stuff.
Like what year? What era was this?
Like 18. Let's see, Babbage. This is a long time ago.
Oh wow! So that's like even before any kind of computers existed. She was writing code.
Yeah, she was writing code. This was Babbage lived until October 1871. So it was sometime in the 1850s to the 1870s. Babbage created the first mechanical computer that eventually led to more complex electronic designs. It's called Babbage's analytical engine. And Ada Lovelace worked closely with him, writing code and her code that's written out in logic form essentially is still persists and has been replicated in sort of virtual environments. It's pretty pretty awesome stuff.
Amazing. Yeah. Man, I feel terrible for the people that make these amazing contributions and they never get to live to see the outcome of what they developed.
Right. Yeah. It's just absolutely looking ahead toward the future. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would be amazing for her to have, you know, somehow time traveled to this time to see what she began.
Yeah. I mean, maybe in some sense we are living the same thing where we're building something that will produce dividends after our lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. I have absolutely no doubt that we are in the midst of the beginning, you know, the 1850s, 70s, 90s of this Bitcoin era. It's the very beginning, mm-hmm. and we have no idea what kind of world it will build, but we have this sort of inkling that it will be something fantastic and you know, it really just draws our attention, and because of that conviction, you know, just drives this insatiable inspiration to work on this as much as possible. And in that sense, Bitcoin sort of, you know, inspires and incentivizes the people that it needs, the minds that it needs to move it forward and make it better and adopt. So
I'm a little selfish. I would like to see some of these things in my lifetime. You know,
I agree, and you know, the benefit that we have, you know, that the early computer leaders and pioneers did not have is that we've had, you know, 50 years of Moore's law, and we're benefiting from insane network effects, you know, as you know, the network effects of the internet itself and the network effects of money combining to create something that can, I think, move far faster than any of us could anticipate.
We also have some benefits. Obviously, information moves at light speed now.
Yes.
Anything that is known on one side of the globe can instantly be, you know, realized the other side. We can communicate over the internet.
Yeah.
I think that we're also entering an era where there's less war. It doesn't feel like it, but the wars are smaller than they once were,
and they're more isolated and concentrated.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't. Yeah. Now, forgive me if somebody's listening to this in 20 years and World War III has happened, but but there is some benefit to having less, you know, small wars, and I think it's also because the images of war can be transmitted a little easier. That I guess maybe there's some like pushback against. Like I don't think you can have a Holocaust in this day and age.
China's trying.
I take my words back already. With the Uyghur people.
But yeah, and we have this information, but you know, it's like what can we do because China is such a, you know, global power on par with the United States, arguably at this point.
Well, the Holocaust was, I don't think most Americans knew it was happening until after World War II ended, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, have you seen Band of Brothers?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Remember that episode towards the end where they stumble across the Auschwitz or something, and they're like, "What the hell is this?"
Yeah.
They didn't realize it was happening the whole time. So right now we can transmit information rapidly across the globe. I think free trade is a great thing. Unfortunately, we've had a little bit of a turn away from it under the current administration, but I think the ability to produce goods in one part of the globe and sell another allows for a lot more global integration. And there was an economist. I think it was Bastiat, but it might have been somebody else who wrote that when goods don't cross borders, armies surely will.
Yes.
So what he was saying is that, when we have free trade, you're less likely to engage in a conflict with somebody that you're engaged in trade with. So that's contributed somewhat.
And I think Bitcoin certainly, you know, moves the needle in that direction, being a non-sovereign global currency. Kind of removes the nation states, you know, aspects of money, you know, the global reserve currencies that we've had over the past 500 or 600 years have been attached to nation states in various forms of gold standards and fiat money standards. But you remove the political implications of, you know, having the reserve currency as your native currency. Obviously, the United States benefits tremendously from, you know, in terms of, you know, global and international control by being the global standard, the global reserve currency. So,
yeah, Yeah. And you could argue that a lot of our intervention in the Middle East has been an impetus to keep the oil trade on a dollar standard.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, because I guess if oil is sold in dollars, that keeps the dollar value high and allows us to kind of maintain our global reserve status.
Yep. And we're at a point now where there's so much debt, global debt denominated in US dollars that the, you know, despite the fact that we're printing a bunch of money, there'll actually be a deflationary effect for a while as all of this, you know, debt and this dollar debt gets unwound around the globe. There'll be demand for dollars to try to settle those debts as best as possible. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, once that unwinding happens, then, it, you know, then it's that demand starts to dry up and then, you know, inflation, you know, kind of happens in earnest. So it's going to be a sight to see.
It's going to be so crazy to see what happens. I mean, I don't, assuming like maybe sometime in the next few years, if maybe if stock to flow is true, or even if it isn't, if the next bull run in Bitcoin happens in the next few years, it's really going to be interesting to see how people react. Like, you know, we all know that typically it happens, all your friends you told about and they ignored it. They all start texting you.
Yeah.
Right. And they say, oh, hey, so still got any of that Bitcoin?
Right. Yeah. 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 The $1 trillion market cap happens at about $55,000 per coin. Mm-hmm. That's a big round number that, you know, puts Bitcoin in a new league, right? I mean, I remember when we passed the $1 billion market cap, or the, I'm sorry, the $100 billion market cap. And that was a big deal during the 2017 run because there are a lot of institutions that have a minimum, you know, asset market cap before they can consider putting money, you know, in, you know, a portion of their portfolio into an asset. And so that was kind of a big deal. But then you cross the $1 trillion market cap and, you know, then it's like, okay, this is a serious global player as an asset. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's just 200 some thousand dollars per coin and you're challenging gold's market cap. And then, you know, it's just what do you do at that point? I mean, you absolutely, as a nation state, as a massive, you know, fund of any kind, that's managing money for, let's say, like, mm-hmm. you know, 401ks or massive unions or universities, you absolutely must, you know, fiduciary responsibility to have some exposure to that asset. So,
yeah,
you know,
and also then, from a psychological perspective, your average person, I guess, okay, but isn't into Bitcoin. They were aware there was some crypto boom in 2017. Maybe they didn't pay a lot of attention to it. I'm guessing a lot of them don't remember the 2013 boom at all. Mm-hmm. So they're aware there was something happened in 2017 where crypto's price went up a lot.
Yeah.
I say crypto because they don't really know the detail behind it. They know Bitcoin is the most prominent one, but there's more than one. But if they hear it again, and this happens again,
yeah,
like, psychologically, how does a person ignore that?
Right, right. Yeah.
I don't even get it. There's friends I've been telling to buy Bitcoin for 7 years now. And they still haven't gotten in. And so they've seen a couple bull runs now. And I don't know how they deny it another time.
Exactly. Yeah. Third time. It's just like you, okay, I was wrong. You know, this is real and I should take a serious look at it.
There's also a thing where like, if I tell somebody to buy Bitcoin multiple times, it's the obvious, he's a kook, so don't listen to him. But if they hear about it on the news mm-hmm. and then they hear it from somebody else, and after, you know, a few points of contact, it that's, people are social creatures and they kind of go with what the crowd does.
Right.
So you hear from multiple angles. That's when I guess the light bulb goes off. Hey, I got to get in this thing.
Yep. Yeah. And I think selling Bitcoin is, this is, you know, as Corey Clipston, our founder at Swan, says, this is the greatest, you know, consumer asset in the history of the world. At least, mm-hmm. I mean, it's certainly the greatest consumer asset on the internet, in the history of the internet, you know, and so being in a position to sell it is fantastic. Like it's a great business model. It already is, you know, because we actually have a decent number of hodlers now, versus like, you know, the last kind of bear cycle when it was like 2015, the dregs mm-hmm. were down 300s, you know, 300s down there.
Oh, it went lower in October of 2015. I remember it dipped under 200. So yeah, this was when in January 2014, right, it hit a peak of like 1,200. Yeah. That was the peak of that bull run. And then the next year and a half was just brutal.
Yeah.
It slid slowly down. And I mean, I still remember, it bottomed out on a little under 200 in October 2015. And then it kind of started picking up back from there.
I mean, the number of hodlers of last resort with faith that this was going to, you know, go through another run at that point was minuscule. And now, you know, we've got a crew, pretty large crew of people who are selling it, marketing it, you know, on ramps that are focused on Bitcoin only and, you know, aren't
so much content. I mean, so it's much embarrassing content. Riches. So I know I was telling you this earlier, but like back in before the current batch of podcasts, so before your podcast, Stefan Levera, TFTC, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. There was in 2013, 14, 15, 16, there was almost nothing. There was Let's Talk Bitcoin with Andreas, and you can't really rely on that because Andreas and his other two co-hosts would chill other stuff then. It was really just Bitcoin Uncensored, which was
Chris Rose.
Yeah, Chris DeRose and John Smith's podcast.
Yeah, and John Smith.
Yeah. They were not coming from an Austrian sound money angle at all.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know if you ever listened to, they have archives of their podcast up somewhere. It's actually pretty fun to listen to, but,
yeah, I agree. Quite a few and they were hilarious dudes.
Mm-hmm. It was like the Howard Stern of Bitcoin. You could say like they were interviewing prostitutes and drug dealers.
Yeah.
Because their thesis was that Bitcoin is for censorship resistance.
Right.
And so the people that benefit from the most are people that can't use the modern banking system. So that'd be people in the sex industry, drug industry. What else? So some things that the government's trying to crack down on in general.
Yeah.
It was a very reverent show. Yeah.
I mean, if you're listening and you're relatively new, 2017, 2018 class, maybe even 2019 or whatever, check out Chris DeRose and Junsith and Bitcoin Uncensored and just have a little fun going back and listening to that stuff. It's
That show is a great marker of history at the time. I actually met them probably a year before they started the podcast.
Yeah.
Because I was living in Miami at the time and they were running the Miami Bitcoin meetups. So I met them like mid 2014 and then they started the podcast like a year later. They kind of went that sort of underground economy black market route.
Yep.
But also they had – the other thing they were doing was debunking the private blockchain narrative, which was very strong back then. So, I mean, these companies have all faded out, but there used to be R3Sev. It was a private blockchain company that basically created a consortium of all these banks. And so they had like Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and Wachovia. They're all part of this consortium that R3Sev has been together to create a private blockchain that were there to use to settle transactions. That was the dominant narrative at the time. There was also Digital Asset Holdings. So this was a startup created by whose CEO was Blythe Masters. She's ex JP Morgan. And I think she was very prominent in like the subprime business in the early 2000s. And then she left JP Morgan to start this company, which is a private blockchain company. I haven't even heard from them in years. It's probably fizzled out. There was an episode of Bitcoin Censored where they interviewed. This is probably one of their most well-known episodes. Everybody should listen to it. They interviewed this girl named Perian Boring. She is the CEO of something at the Blockchain Council, which is a lobby group in Washington, D.C. for the blockchain Bitcoin industry. And they have her on, and it's clue she has no clue what a blockchain. It's apparent that she has no clue what a blockchain is. Like she's arguing they get her on the record stating that Swift and ACH are blockchains. So at that point, like back in 2014, 15, 16, like the term blockchain was just totally being muddled. I'm talking separate from. I mean, all coins are one thing, especially if they're proof of work based. They exist, and I mean, there's arguments against them, but they are blockchains. But there was the whole private blockchain concept where it was going to be completely centralized, run by a company, but there was going to be some amorphous benefit, which I have no clue what distinguishes it from a database. But that was a prominent narrative that's thankfully died out, and you don't really hear it anymore. So really now it's just Bitcoin versus all coins. Yeah. I mean, hopefully proof of stake will someday die out. I don't know if their Ethereum will just stop talking about that someday.
It was the next sort of Ethereum thing before mm-hmm. DeFi, right?
They said it from the beginning. From the very beginning, they said proof of work is wasteful. It's environmentally damaging.
Yeah.
So we're going to do this proof of stake scheme. And I mean, that, you know, is Vlad Zamfir is? He supposedly had conjured up the idea of it. And I mean, for years now, they've said it's just around the corner.
Yeah.
Now their ETH 2.0 is supposed to happen soon. It's literally just a series of shifting narratives.
Sharding and which is just a hilarious name. They're going to shard everything out. And then, the ICOs. So, I mean, these are all the different narratives of Ethereum. World Computer, ICOs.
Internet 3.0. If you go on their YouTube.
If
you go on the Ethereum Foundation's YouTube, one of their very first videos, marketing Bitcoin or marketing Ethereum, is that Ethereum is the Internet 3.0. And if I'm actually on their YouTube page right now, it's so ridiculously like overhyped. Like, it makes it seem as though Ethereum is just gonna do everything.
Yeah,
like they world computer was a term. It was gonna do everything for you.
Yeah.
It was gonna handle payments. It was gonna process all your data. You didn't do anything. You just turn it on or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it was gonna replace or run on top of TCP/IP and make everything better. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, because every single piece of data would be archived on the Ethereum blockchain, and mm-hmm. therefore, you know, just everyone to access at any given time, and it's gonna scale, no problem. Blockchains are not for running an entire internet upon. It's not an internet database, a database for the entire internet. No, that does not work. It's like, it's useful for money, and you know, maybe some other curious collectibles if you want to have your own blockchain for that. But digital scarcity, and that's about it.
I think we're always going to be facing this kind of issue where it's very cheap to make a blockchain, right? All you have to do is fork an existing one, and then you can include your little pre-mine, and then it's really your only expenses are marketing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people have to get burned, and so I'm not optimistic in the near term that all coins are going to die out. Some people seem to think that the next bull run is going to be Bitcoin only, but I think that people have to understand that the things that we know, very few people outside of us in our circle knows.
Exactly.
So you got to imagine the your grandma or someone like that getting in, and then they're getting all these marketing flyers.
I mean, I do hope that we siphon off and save a larger percentage of mm-hmm. new coiners than were siphoned off and saved as Bitcoin only relatively quickly in the last run. These altcoins, their only purpose is for traders to pump and dump and make more Bitcoin. That's it.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And, you know, there's going to be plenty of people who fall prey to this marketing, and it's good. I'll grant it. Their marketing efforts are good. And then that's where they work. And they're going to bring a bunch of people into their little mm-hmm. cultish marketing practices, and they're going to pump up the price versus BTC, and they're going to dump on them. And, you know, that's it. I mean, that's the way it's going to work. And it's going to happen. It's hard to stop.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about, maybe it's just human nature, that we're attracted to the idea of getting rich quick.
Yeah. No, yeah, for sure. For sure. I was talking one of our internal team, like just kind of chats today, and we were saying, Cardano and a couple others are up, 300-400% against Bitcoin in the past few months. And then we looked at zoomed out and looked at the full chart, and it's still 90% down versus Bitcoin. But you look at that 300-400% pump, and you're like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't mind like tripling my Bitcoin. That would be nice. And it's everybody's susceptible to it,
Yeah.
I mean, you can't, that thought that cannot escape your head. It's got to be there. And so, it's just hard to resist those things because eventually you can't, maybe you get lucky that one time, but you try mm-hmm. it again and again and you get wrecked, and you want to put in, you're like, okay, I'm only going to put in 10% of my stack Just, you know, just to gamble a little bit, it works. All right, I'm going to put in half my stack and I'm really going to nail it. I'm going to be a whale. You know, I'm going for 21 Bitcoin. I'm going for 100 Bitcoin. Wrecked. You know, you get leverage on it. It's just the same old story.
I think people have to understand that trading is like poker. Exactly. For every winner, there's a loser, but it's not as a whole. It's not actually a productive thing.
Right. Yep. Absolutely. Well, and the winners tend to be necessarily like 1 or 2%.
Because trading does have a role in terms of price discovery, so it's good to have trading in markets.
Liquidity. But, liquidity, yeah, exactly. Is there, and so there's good. That's good.
But yeah. For every winner, there's a loser, and the winners are people who they're gonna be better than you. I mean, it's as simple. Like if I go to Vegas, every time I go to Vegas, I lose money because I'm sitting at a table with people that are better than me. Exactly. And when you're trading, there's people out there that are better than you, and you might get lucky here and there, but chances are you're going to lose your money.
Yeah.
Now, the argument against this, some people say, well, the crypto economy is up, so I've made money trading. But the reality is you would have made money even if you held.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Everybody did great. Everybody was a awesome trader and amazing in 2017. Fucking everyone killed it. We're all awesome.
Everybody's a genius in a bull market.
Yeah. And then the tax bill comes and you're like, oh, and then you have to sell off that Bitcoin profits and, you know, it's and people, you know, the average noob doesn't even think about that kind of stuff, doesn't take them into account. They don't understand, you know, how to, you know, set limits and protect and hedge. And, you know, they're just setting market orders and hoping that they get hit. And, you know, it's a whole game. And if you sit down at the table and in the first 5 minutes, you don't spot the sucker, you are the sucker. So, I mean, it's just sitting down with a bunch of sharks and just don't do it. Just don't do it.
Yeah. People just want to get rich. I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you'd have these little magazines and in the back there'd be ads for like, oh, send $50 to this address to this PO box and we'll send you like something that will teach you how to get rich quick.
Right. Yeah.
I fell for it once or twice that you learn.
Yeah.
You learn by, you know, putting your hand on the stove and burning yourself.
It's like the Twitter hacker last week, man. This guy gets access to, you know, a dozen of the most powerful accounts on the world's most consequential, you know, social network, and, you know, just decides to throw up some shitty little, you know, you send me $1,000 of Bitcoin, I'll send you back $2,000 of Bitcoin scam.
Uh-huh.
You know,
people fell for it. That's an old scam.
Still, people fell for it. Yeah. And I mean, it's just the simplest scam possible.
Yeah. So how much did you get in that address?
I think it ended up being like 180K.
Oh, wow. You think 18. Any of that, some people theorize, though, that he was maybe sending himself money just to bump up the number or something.
Right. I think that's kind of common practice when scammers run that sort of a scam. They you know, kind of seed the wallet with a certain number of Bitcoin to make it look like people are actually doing it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it was kind of amateur hour. So I think the people who, you know, people or person who pulled that off was just like, shocked that they did and didn't know what to do.
But, yeah, it's incredible. You know, fiat money is making people so stupid. That's what it does. Fiat ultimately it encourages stupidity.
Yeah.
That and socialism. But you know, Bitcoin, I mean, it's so precious. Like, there's only so much. You feel like you have to. You become like miserly, like Ebenezer Scrooge. Like you don't want to let up a sad. So you become much more skeptical about all the things that are, you know, thrown your way. All the quote unquote opportunities.
Yeah, you know, everyone's going to have a time preference, but you think very carefully about what's a need versus a nice to have. And so it creates an economy where, you know, it's governed by collective economic self-interest, and that only works if your economic self-interest in regards to your money actually incentivizes you to hold it and think carefully about how you spend it. If your money incentivizes you to spend it on whatever the hell you can that actually has some hard value, some like actual natural scarcity to it, mm-hmm. then you're just gonna spend, and debt becomes the money. I mean,
yeah, you know, I mean, I think Pierre Richard has talked a lot about this and some others, but we basically turned into an economy of degenerate gamblers because exactly. we can't just hold money. So everyone's spending their money in stocks, real estate. Everyone's searching for the newest thing. I had, I'm currently in medicine. I'm a family medicine resident. And one of my old surgery attendings, I told him like a year ago about Bitcoin. So he's a surgeon. So he obviously has a pretty income. And so I saw him again this like about a few weeks ago, a year later. And I said, hey, did you ever like take me up on that advice? And and he's like, no, you know, I put my money in this like startup. And
yeah.
I could see like the look on his face. And it's yeah. like, he's like, you can see like he's already like down or something. You know, it's just. People
not encouraged.
Exactly. People are always trying to find the next big thing because you can't hold on to your money.
You can't hold on to your cash. You can't rely on it. So yeah, I mean, so this was a doctor, right?
Yep. Yeah. Well, yeah. He's a general surgeon.
Right. So, okay. So here's a great example, right? He's a general surgeon, mm-hmm. but he's making money and he gets paid and he sees that his money is losing value by 2%. Or more, because that's just kind of the reported target percentage. Mm-hmm. But we actually know through like shadow stats and other services, like the inflation rate is actually higher than that, especially over the past few years. So your money is losing value as it's just sitting there in cash. So you're like, okay, I am a smart individual and I'm earning this money with hard work. So I'm going to find a way to actually increase the value of that money over time and generate wealth. Okay, so now I need to become, I have to research and find somebody I actually trust with my money to, you know, increase its wealth. But most likely, if I'm a smart individual like that, I don't want to trust somebody with my money. So I'm going to learn it myself. And I remember as a kid, my stepdad was a nephrologist. He was a doctor. And mm-hmm. he spent hours and hours and hours watching cable TV about finances and reading books and like developing his own models and just, you know, trying to, you know, turn his
a nephrologist income, like
right yes hours and hours and hours just, exactly and that had to happen because money was unnatural money that was being artificially controlled, arbitrarily controlled by a few people to benefit the, you know, national treasury and the 21 banks that are closest to the Federal Reserve. Like mm-hmm. that's it. And how, then that's, you spread that across the entire economy. And we have been robbed of a future that would have been incredible with the deflationary technologies that we have, you know, at this point in time.
We'd be living like Star Trek now.
Yeah, essentially. Like, you know.
It's hard to explain this. I try to tell this to like, people are socialists, but like if not for the last century of statism, so
right.
fiat money, warfare, the welfare state,
yes.
You know, all the social welfare programs have gone along with it, we would be so far ahead technologically such that even the poorest person would be better off than the richest person today. So a good example is I like to say that even the poorest person alive today is better off than John D. Rockefeller. John D. Rockefeller is the wealthiest person in human history. He owned at his peak, like his personal net worth was 1-2% of all the money in America. Even Jeff yeah. Bezos today isn't at that wealthy. He's wealthier probably more in nominal terms, but not in real inflation adjusted terms.
Right.
But John D. Rockefeller did not have pretty much the poorest people on earth live better than John D. Rockefeller. He didn't have TV. I'm not sure if he had a radio. Radio might have been towards the end of his life.
Probably had a telegraph.
Yeah. Didn't have internet, computers, smartphones, none of that stuff. He probably had a lot of servants. Maybe, I don't know if they had refrigeration was common in his time. He lived from late 1800s to very early 1900s. But I mean, pretty much the average, even poor person lives better than today. I mean, maybe not a homeless person. But even in medicine, I mean, I'll tell you what, if a homeless person walks into an emergency room right now and yeah. they're having a heart attack, there's no question of cost. They're taken to the cath lab to have a stent put in their heart. But in 1955, the sitting president of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower, had a heart attack. You know what they gave him? Aspirin. That's it. that was his treatment. That was a cutting edge treatment in 1955.
Yeah.
So the living standards have increased over this time, but they would have increased so much faster.
Right.
It's really about increasing the rate of economic growth such that even the poor people of the future are better than off than the rich people today. We need to focus on growing the pie as opposed to cutting up the pie into different slices.
Yeah.
That's the problem with socialists, is they're so obsessed with cutting the pie in a different way that they're actually shrinking the pie.
Yeah. I mean, this is, and we think of like, you know, monetary policy and financial responsibility and these ideas of like managing debt and stuff like that. We think of these as sort of conservative political ideas. At least, you know, they were a couple decades ago or something. But, you know, even Nixon, when he took us off the gold standard and Milton Friedman, you know, 5 or 6 years before that, coined the phrase, you know, we're all Keynesians now. That, you know, at that point, the monetary policy differences between the parties really just kind of ended. You know, like, you know, Ron Paul kind of made a push for auditing the Fed, and you know, Clinton made a deal about reducing the deficit and balancing the budget and all that stuff. But lip service to that stuff. But we are completely, you know, beyond that now, through the looking glass, to completely embracing you know, like targeted inflation, and absolutely just like word for word admitted by representatives of the Federal Reserve that you know, we have infinite cash, we will do whatever it takes. So yeah, I mean, we have monetary socialism now as policy.
And there's no limit to the growth of government as long as money is infinite, then yeah, there's no way stopping socialism because they can just print more.
Right. UBI becomes a thing. And, you know, obviously, like, national free healthcare will become the next thing. It's just, you know, that will last. That will work. And it'll be obviously politically popular. I wouldn't be surprised if we got another airdrop of Trump bucks, you know, in the next few months. You want to do it a little bit closer to the election day, you know, so it's fresh in people's minds. But that's literally bribing people for votes. Mm-hmm. And it'll work, you know, until it doesn't. And the inevitable end of any fiat money, as we know, taught by history, is hyperinflation. And that will happen. And now we have this non-sovereign alternative whatever sort of Frankenstein's monster of money they try to come up with, the nation states try to come up with and agree upon in like a Bretton Woods 2024-25, you know, so it'll be some kind of Bancor like, you know, maybe it'll include some gold and other assets, and they'll try to create some new global reserve asset, but we'll have Bitcoin, and where will the trust be, right? Money is about trust. Where will the trust be? Will it be with these governments coming together to rescue the rest of the world, or is it going to be in this non-sovereign, very stable, you know, very trustworthy protocol for money on the internet that it's already preferred by, you know, the next generation to really come into power, the millennials?
Yeah, native, we have an escape hatch now.
Yeah,
yeah, we have a way out.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's terrifying. I mean, there's a lot of damage that can be done between now and then. Just because as the dependency grows, and I mean, we're kind of seeing this today with all the riots and protests. We're just seeing a generation of people that are totally disaffected, where their wage growth has been stunted, and then so they're kind of lashing out against the system, but they don't really know where to direct their anger.
Yes.
So they're sort of directing against businessmen as opposed to, you know, the central banks and the state that are sort of perpetuating this. I mean, Starbucks is not the reason why you're poor.
Right.
It's the Fed.
Exactly. It's the Fed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you can be mad at Starbucks, and you can be mad at the big banks, because they are getting the lion's share of that money, or at least they're getting it at lower interest rates than you are. So they're just taking that cut without doing absolutely anything. It's the ultimate middleman scam.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, we've got to get, I mean, this is our chance. This is Bitcoiners' chance to really get out there. And we've been talking, you know, kind of internally and amongst other Bitcoiners, like, you know, this idea of Bitcoin marketing that Dan Held is really pushing, but there's, you know, pushback against that idea. I'm all for it. Like, I think that, you know, Bitcoin, there is Bitcoin marketing, such a thing. It's us out there promoting it collectively. I don't think there's a central marketing department or a CEO or a CMO or anything like that, obviously, but, you know, us just getting out there and talking about why Bitcoin is important and better is, I think, a distributed organic marketing, a form of distributed organic marketing. And we need to get people out there in the mainstream media more and more talking about these things, these fundamental, you know, fundamentally teach people about what money is. That's the most important thing. That's the tip of the rabbit hole, is what money really is. Mm-hmm. And if you teach people that and teach people how money, you know, this unnatural money that we have now is robbing them of their time and productivity over, you know, insidiously over decades. And then we have this, you know, alternative option that will actually, you know, benefit you over those decades. Your wealth will grow over time. Then, you know, I think the case is made and you got to get some. And mm-hmm. then the flywheels is going. So,
yeah. And you also mentioned, that like fiat money allows large companies to borrow at lower interest rates. I mean, this has a lot of, yep. that point alone has a lot of negative consequences. Like, it allows Google and Apple and the other major tech companies to just buy up lots of startups.
Yep.
And I mean, a lot of times when they buy them up, they end up mismanaging them, but they can afford to do that because they have access to cheap credit.
Right.
Or, I mean, another alternative, which people may not realize, is that, you know, in a lot of, you know, when I was a kid, I was a really big comic book nerd, and still am to some extent. But like, one of the things that's happening lately in the comic book world is, you know, Disney about 10 years ago bought Marvel. And since then, the quality of the actual Marvel comics has gone downhill because they just hired a bunch of woke people to write all the comics.
Right.
Right. So, I mean, just as an example, people, if you're not really in that world, might not realize it, but like Iron Man, they've replaced him with a younger, like, teenage African-American girl is a new Iron Man. They've race and gender swapped all the characters. It's kind of crazy. But they can only do that because Disney doesn't really, you know, they're a major corporation. They don't really need the revenue. Whereas Marvel was once upon a time a smaller company that had to rely on readers to actually satisfy, you know, write good stories.
Right.
You know, back when I was a kid, but you know, that era is gone. So it has all these manifestations in areas that you can't even imagine. They say housing, you know, you build a house nowadays and it's built with, like, you know, crappy, you know, pieces, like, you know, the wood and all the floorboard and stuff. It's all made of low quality stuff because, you know, they're just trying to skip corners.
Yep. Yeah. Because, I mean, otherwise it's too expensive to buy.
Yep. There's shrinkflation, everything you buy. You know, if you get like a thing of ice cream from the store,
yeah,
it's smaller than what it was, you know, a few decades back. Everything is shrinkflation, is what they call it.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense too. And like, I had a new house was built a couple blocks away from me by a good friend of mine, and I'm, you know, really happy for him. He's getting into that game. He's, you know, been a contractor in construction for a mm-hmm. long time, and he's finally, like, you know, heading the project and building his house and selling it. And it's essentially the same house that I live in, but my house is, you know, like, what is it now? Like 18 years old, you know, and this house that he built is, their asking price is twice as much as mine. I mean, it's just, you know, it's been 18 years and I'm just like flabbergasted. I'm like, I can't believe that a house in this neighborhood is selling for that price. And then, I mean, here's going back to what we were just talking about. The zombie firms, right? Like, it allows Apple and these big companies to invest in companies that, you know, aren't necessarily worth investing in or worth keeping around. So there's this great graph that I got from WTF happened in 1971.com, and it's titled the U.S. Rising Share of Companies with Debt Servicing Costs That Are Higher Than Profits. So these are termed zombie firms. All right. And so this is the percent of companies that fit this description in the United States. So we're talking like negligible 0 to 1% through the 90s. Starts going up after the 2001 financial crisis. It's about 2% just before 2008. And just drastically goes parabolic, essentially, up to almost 20% of companies in 2020 have debt servicing costs that are higher than profits. And the mm-hmm. only way that you can keep these firms alive is money printing. And you got to have that money go somewhere. And so it gets invested in these shitty companies that should be left to die and be replaced, you know, in the ashes, rising from the ashes, companies that better serve the market in more efficient ways. But that doesn't happen, you know?
And people forget that when a company goes bankrupt, it's not like, you know, all the assets die. The building is sold off and somebody else can use it. All of the capital yes. equipment is sold off and somebody else can use it. So in essence, it gets reorganized. Now, there may be some unemployment, but that, in essence, in a free market, at least, balances it out because wages will adjust such that new job opportunities will become more feasible.
Right.
So exactly. Basically, the economy just restructures it from a poor investment in a bad company into more making other better quality investments more feasible. But you don't see that reorganization occurring because the old firm is kept propped up.
Exactly.
That reminds me of the Cash for Clunkers program. Do you remember that? That was under Obama.
I do remember that.
Yeah, he was buying people's he was using federal money to subsidize people to trade in their old car and then they would destroy it and then you could use that convert towards a new car. So what that does was because people were able to they were just basically getting rid of the old cars, it actually kept the price of used cars up artificially. So a lot of poor people who couldn't afford to buy a new car one way or another, they typically buy used cars, right? But they couldn't afford to because the supply was dried up. So it actually harmed poor people, but you never heard about that in the news because it was touted as a way, it's essentially an auto industry bailout. But it's a way of just preventing reorganization of capital.
Yep.
Absolutely. In the economy to more productive uses.
Exactly.
And we're seeing that everywhere. It's getting worse.
Yep.
Yep.
And the forest, I mean, you know, the natural cycle, there's these sort of forest fires that will, you know, burn down these older companies and make available resources to be reincorporated into a new businesses that better serve the market more efficiently. Mm-hmm. But you keep all of that detritus around and, you know, when the fire finally does come, it's going to be that much more extreme, you know, and harder to recover from. So it's
basically the business cycle in Austrian theory. Now everything is going bankrupt at the same time. Whereas within sound money, companies go bankrupt at different times. So there isn't these sudden depressions and then followed by big booms and another depression. It's more steady.
Yep, exactly. And I hope that this is the future that we have to look forward to is, you know, based an economy based on natural money that mm-hmm. will reward, ingenuity and product market fit, customer service, and create a world where we have to spend a lot less time to procure the necessities of a quality human life, and therefore we get to spend a lot more time on our passions and our, you know, the artisanry that we want to pursue and develop, and we'll see, you know, human ingenuity flourish and all kinds of, you know, arts, works of arts and wonder and technology that will take us to the stars and live that Star Trek life, man, that you were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, right?
Oh yeah, that'll be incredible. I mean, I think we'll make huge advances in medicine, art, pretty much every field.
Yep.
So much, it's just all the waste will just be squeezed out of the system. There's so much waste. I see it in my line of work where there's just a ton of waste, you know, and people know that the healthcare system is kind of, it's sort of a bubble in some sense, where it's not built on consumer value. It's built on like checking boxes and just sort of delivering some service, but not really solving the underlying problems. And unfortunately it's kind of perpetuated itself over time. And we see in lots of industries outside of healthcare. I mean, education is just a giant bubble where I mean, the student loan crisis is basically a manifestation of cheap credit being extended to students, right?
Right.
The government provides guaranteed loans to the students. So you have to. So now the colleges respond by raising tuition because they know that you can borrow against the government no matter how high their tuition is. And right. then it creates a cycle where the government has to increase the loan amounts and then tuition rises. And then that's why the cost of college education has just risen exponentially over the last 50 years. And we have like, I don't know, several $1 trillion in student loan debt. That's another bubble waiting to burst.
Yeah, absolutely. The everything bubble waiting to burst.
Yeah.
And there's going to be pain and suffering. And I feel for that. I have empathy and sympathy for everyone who's going to be suffering from what's to come. And I, you know, that's why we're out here, man, doing our thing to try to say, hey, there we have a safety hatch, you know, build one, whatever size you can, or hop into somebody else's and just be ready. Hopefully that will help blunt the pain that you're about to experience. Gold bugs have been talking about this for decades, and it never seems to, the big crack-up boom never seems to come to fruition. But my God, I can't imagine that we're too much further away from it at this point. All the writing's on the wall, signs are there, and I think just the presence of Bitcoin itself will sort of hasten it along, mm-hmm. as Bitcoin sort of siphons off that easy shitty money.
One of the criticisms of Austrians is that, you know, they predicted 10 out of the last 5 recessions.
Yeah.
Right. So. That, right. like, you know, Austrians forever have been predicting the breakup of the fiat money standard.
Yep.
And to some extent, that's true. I mean, you've been hearing for decades now, guys like Ron Paul, Tom Woods, others before them, that, you know, this is going to collapse any day now, and it hasn't. But the reason why is because we haven't had a good alternative. So the system could perpetuate itself because we couldn't escape it. Now we can escape it. There's an escape hatch. We have a way to get out. And so there's, you know, we have a much better system evolving in front of us. And hopefully that'll kind of push the system to collapse a little sooner, because I don't want to go through this another 20, 30 years.
Yep. Bitcoin will siphon that off slowly, mm-hmm. but surely, gradually, then suddenly. And that S curve of adoption that we see happen over and over and over for technologies will happen mm-hmm. for this monetary technology. And at that point, it's game on. Bitcoin is here on the global stage, and I just don't see how fiat monies can compete. Even if governments try to, you know, reinstitute some kind of gold standard, you know, the trust has been broken. There's a new kid on the block that works and has proven to work for decades, and you know, like I said, the generation coming up behind the boomers and the Gen Xers, the largest generation since the boomers, the millennials, or digital natives, will, you know, have much more innate trust in a digitally native money than mm-hmm. any generation that has come before. So
yeah, I mean, there will be that iPhone moment, you know, like, I mean, there are smartphones before the iPhone, the BlackBerry, the most prominent of them. But there was that iPhone moment where everybody started piling into it. Starting, I think that was 2007 when the iPhone debuted. And then pretty much now everybody has a smartphone. And it's kind of interesting to think, like, you know, when will that iPhone moment come for Bitcoin? When everybody just sort of, I mean, it might not be a device like that makes it easy, but it'll be just a spreading of just the consciousness that people need to get into this thing before it's too late for them. And it could, you know, I think I kind of agree with Bitcoin Tina. You've had him on the podcast before, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I think he makes a very good point that this could happen.
Actually, I haven't had him on this podcast. I did only briefly in a 2019 Bitcoin sort of like episode where I had a bunch of people on, but he has been on Swan Signal Live just a few weeks ago. So you'll find that there.
Oh, you know what? Yeah. I think I have it saved in my queue, but I haven't listened to that one yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, he makes a point that this will probably happen. This could happen very much faster than even the internet adoption, because the internet, there's no specific benefit. I mean, there's benefits to adopting the internet earlier, right? But, you know, there's no financial reward for getting into the internet and adopting email in 1994 as opposed to 1998. You didn't financially benefit. But Bitcoin, the earlier you get in, the better. So that could lead an impetus to where you have to, you adopt it much faster, because everybody wants to get in before it's too late.
Yep. Yep.
So, I mean, we could, this could be done in 2-10 years, you know?
Exactly.
Or it could take the rest of our lives. I don't know. I try to temper my expectations because.
Well, I mean, we underestimate, you know, short term and overestimate long term, mm-hmm. or overestimate long short term. It's the other way around.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is something that I think will happen very suddenly at some point, and who knows how far away we are from that point. But I definitely think that what has transpired over the past few months has brought that date forward significantly. So Bitcoiners, mm-hmm. hang on, this is our time, you know, buckle down, get your ducks in a row, make sure that you have your shit in multi-sig, you know, make sure you have your like mixed stash, just get all that stuff done right now and start shilling. Just start softly shilling. I know a lot of you have already, but now it's time to double down and revisit and say like, hey, you know, family, like I'm looking out for you. I'm not crazy. This thing is a hedge. It's an insurance policy against all of the scary shit that's happening. People feel the fear, and fear works as a motivator. So get out there and use, you know, leverage that fear to get friends and family on board, just with a little bit, 1%, 2%, just get a little bit of exposure. That's all it will take to really help if this thing does just, you know, S curve up and go parabolic.
300,000 sats per person, right? That's, you know, if you take 21 million divided by 7 billion. So
yeah, exactly.
Like less than $30.
Yep. That's like, I mean, yeah, you put in $100 and you're going to be triple the, you know, average amount of sats per person. You know, that's all it takes right now.
Exactly. But then, you know, what always happens is no matter how much, I swear to God, no matter how much Bitcoin you have, you always want more. It never ends.
Yeah, it never ends. Like, I mean, greed is a natural human instinct and emotion. And so Bitcoin plays off that, benefits from that, mm-hmm. you know. So, and what I think is a beautiful thing about Bitcoin is that you take greed and collect, you know, economic self-interest, but then you look at economic self-interest on a social, on a societal level, collectively, and it creates something beautiful. It creates, an efficient economy that will, you know, create a deflationary, efficient economy that will help all of us become, you know, more affluent and have more time to do what we want to do, etc. So it's amazing, and that's how greed is supposed to work on a grand level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, dude.
Yeah,
man. Could have said it better.
All right, dude. Let's drop it right there. That was a great rip. We went for like over an hour and a half.
Yeah,
can't wait to share this one. I think everyone's gonna really love it.
Absolutely, dude. Yeah, so, thanks for doing all you do.
Thank you. Appreciate it, man. Yep. And hey, I'm super excited when we fired up the video at the beginning of the chat and you had a Citizen Bitcoin shirt on. That's the first time that's happened. Fucking love it. Y'all can do the same. Check out Nick Ward's layer1btc.com.
Some
Citizen Bitcoin gear there.
I'm wearing this shirt right now. I think it's very comfortable. It's just the cotton is feels really nice. The logo, Brady, your logo is beautiful. It's just so simplistic, but I like it a lot.
Oh man,
I've had people ask me in public about it. I showed Bitcoin to somebody. Start. Yeah, I wore it to. I was telling you, I wore it to a bank, and the teller there asked me about it, and I got to show Bitcoin a little bit to them. So it starts conversations.
There you go, man. Some conversations. There you go. Like, and Nick Ward, you know, props to you. Nick designed the logo. I absolutely love it too. It's the inspiration is the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see the sort of sun with the Bitcoin at the center rising over the horizon. And that's where we're at, man. We're here at the beginning. We're all privileged to be here at the beginning. And I think when we look back 20 years from now, we'll all be really proud to have been here and together, and we'll have lasting friendships. You know, I want to go to a Bitcoin conference in 20 years with all of you all and just kind of sit down and look back and shoot the shit about the early days. It's going to be a good time. I love it.
Yeah. Although I will say there will be a little bit bittersweet to this, because as the movement grows bigger, there will be a lot of new people. So we, I mean, as anything gets bigger, it's like kind of being into a band before they become popular.
Exactly.
And they become popular, and there's thousands or millions of new fans. The original voices do get diluted. That's kind of part of the journey.
Yeah, true. True that. That'll happen. That'll happen. All right, bro.
Yep.
I'll see you out on Bitcoin Twitter, man. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely, man. Take care.
All right. All right, thanks to Vake for joining me, man. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate your time. You can find him on Bitcoin Twitter at Vakeraj, at V-A-K-E-R-A-J. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world, as in the renaissance that will be spreading around the world when we adopt Bitcoin as our global reserve currency. Share this one with your family and friends. Share it with all of your friends on Bitcoin Twitter. You know, share it out there. Tell them you love the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. Let's get this thing spreading. Give me a review, a rating on Apple Podcasts. Keep those coming in. I see those trickling in now every once in a while. I don't really ask for them anymore, but I love seeing them come in. And, you know, might as well ask now. Go throw a couple of reviews out there for me. It does help as we get this pump going, as we wait, you know, for this next bull run. The price is coiling tight right now. We're going to see some action. The volatility will return one way or the other, but eventually the trend is going to go up. And as number goes up, attention comes in. Let's make the Citizen Bitcoin right up there at the top of the feed when people start adding Bitcoin podcasts to their podcast feeds. All right. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this episode, and to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the Citizen Bitcoin podcast in the feed. Check out my merchandise shop at layer1btc.com. Hey, Vake had on a Citizen Bitcoin shirt, and I was freaking thrilled to see that. That was so cool. There's also some OPSEC friendly designs there, like the Unfuck the Money shirt and the Strategically Applied Toxicity shirt. That's SAT, right? For short, apply SAT, Strategically Applied Toxicity, to all those shitcoin scammers, all right? We're not just, you know, like completely toxic to anybody without any discretion. No indiscriminate toxicity here. We strategically apply it where needed to protect people from falling prey to shitcoin scams. So check out layer1btc.com, click on partners, and then Citizen Bitcoin. You'll find my collection there. Check out the podcast, like I noted at the top, that we created for Swan Signal Podcast. You can find it at swansignalpodcast.com. Go hit subscribe on that right now. All right, if you have any questions for me, would love to talk to you. Reach out to me in my DMs. That's the easiest way to find me, and I'll respond fastest there. You can also find me at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram. My email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.